listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It becomes harder and harder to do the kinds of stories that the press was doing back in the 1970s. I was with the Associated Press during this period.
That was the voice of the late award-winning journalist Robert Parry, the founder of ConsortiumNews.com, best known for his role in covering the Iran-Contra affair for the Associated Press and Newsweek, and the scandal involving the CIA and Contras trafficking cocaine in the U.S., which broke in 1985. These clips from an interview in 2010 present what was pretty much Parry's stock discussion of the history of journalism in the U.S., beginning in the late 1960s, which he saw up close and personal. Here he describes some of his own experiences at the Associated Press.
I was on the special assignment team, and in trying to dig into some of these stories became something that was more and more of a career risk. And a lot of journalists who tried to do these stories ended up having very bad outcomes. One of the famous cases dealt with Raymond Bonner, who was a New York Times correspondent in Central America. And he was describing these death squad activities that were underway by right-wing government supported by the Reagan administration. And that wasn't acceptable to the Reagan people. So they began to attack him. They had their outside groups try to question his ethics and the quality of his journalism. And when he did a major piece about a massacre that had occurred in 1981 at a place called El Mazote, and he exposed this in early 82, just as Reagan was putting out a report saying that the Salvadoran military was now acting in respect of human rights, that was very embarrassing for the Reagan people. So they went after Ray Bonner even more. And ultimately, the New York Times, which had an executive editor, Abe Rosenthal, who was also sympathetic to the neoconservative cause, basically Bonner was pulled out, given a humiliating assignment, and ultimately forced out of the New York Times. And that kind of message was being sent to all of us, that if you really cared about your career, you don't go to certain places. You don't write certain stories.
Robert Parry passed away this past January 27th, but not before creating an alternative to the restrictive corporate media that he refers to here. That alternative, his legacy, consortiumnews.com, now has journalist Joe Loria at the helm, and we spoke with him via Skype from Washington, D.C., Tuesday.
It was a complete shock when Bob died on 27 January. But I have a lot of thanking the board of the Consortium for Independent Journalism that appointed me as editor-in-chief, and I'm not even going to try to fill his shoes, as people have been saying. It's impossible to do that. I'm going to do whatever I can to, the best way I can, to keep his legacy alive, which was principled and nonpartisan journalism, and to expand coverage. I got several ideas, so I want to build up the site more to get more readers, but it's never going to touch the core of what Bob Parry created, and that's because I happen to agree with what Bob created, both what he wrote and the principles he stood for.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't think there's, I really can't think of who else I might say this about to you particularly, but yeah, those are some pretty big shoes to fill. He did an awful lot of stuff, and you are no slouch, which is why I prefaced it that way. You're somebody that I've been following for a very long time, looking at foreign affairs when you were at the UN. I've been a fan, quote unquote, and a consumer, and someone being educated by you more or less for most of my adult life. So, and yet I'm looking at, geez, if I were you, looking at Robert's shoes, yeah, those are some big shoes to fill, aren't they?
I feel. Well, thank you for that, Don. I had no idea that you were lurking in the background reading.
Yeah,
myself.
Exactly. Yeah, right. That was me.
But I feel a little like Babe Daldrin. Do you know who that is?
No, who's that?
Does anybody in your audience know? No, I don't think so.
I don't see any hands.
He's the guy who took over at first base for Lou Gehrig.
Ah, I hear you.
And I hope decades from now I'm not as forgotten as Babe Daldrin is, but certainly no one's going to forget Bob Parry, as no one has forgotten Lou Gehrig. So,
yeah.
No, it is something. Look, Bob, as I said in my talk, and there were some really good speeches at the memorial on Saturday at the Pentagon City Sheraton Hotel here in Northern Virginia. Bob was the only editor who ever understood what I was writing about and accepted it. I spoke at length about how he started Consortium News, and it was essentially because he got fed up with his editors at AP and then Newsweek killing stories of great national significance related to the Iran-Contra scandal. They would edit the thing out, take out any reference to the CIA. They spiked stories. They kept delaying that. It was clear what they were doing. One story he's often told that I repeated was that he went to a dinner in Washington where Brett Scowcroft, who was the current at the time national security advisor, was present. And well, it came up about one of these stories, and Bob's editor came over to him from Newsweek and told him that they had to suppress the story for the good of the country. Mm. And as I pointed out, they were really talking about for the good of the rulers of the country, not for the rest of
right.
us. And so he started, he got fed up and started Consortium News with his two sons, Nat and Sam. And the idea behind it was to create a consortium for other journalists in the mainstream who kept getting their stories suppressed, could not get them published. And so he provided a place where these articles could be published that were being rejected mainly for political reasons. He did it in 1995. That was an era where people were doing dial-up modems for AOL and CompuServe. So it was one of the earliest, and it might be the very first, news or investigative news website ever created. It was Bob had actually not even heard of the internet. It was his son Sam who told
right.
him about this thing.
Yep.
And well, it's been around for 22 years now,
wow.
23 years. And he built it up into something extraordinary. It did not get the attention and reach that I think he and others wanted, but it was a serious website. It is one that was read here in Washington by powerful people. I've been told just recently that his articles go to the office of the president of Russia, and also Trump has been shown articles. So while it doesn't have the reach that we'd want, and I'm hoping to expand that by bringing in new writers and covering new topics, it does have some kind of influence here. in Washington. So that was because Bob was the whole show.
Yeah.
And that is one of the other difficult things about taking over. He did everything. He raised funds. He moderated the comments. He wrote a piece almost every day, and he edited 3 or 4 stories. I don't know how the man did it. I will not be able to work at that pace with that energy. I'm just getting started. I ask for patience. I'm ramping this thing up. They're going to be – I brought in 3 or 4 new writers already, people like Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report. I was very happy to have her in there. And I want to cover like labor issues. Labor used to be something that every metropolitan newspaper had 1 or 2 reporters covering, and now it doesn't exist. Right. And issues about women and struggle in the developing countries. I want to write maybe about climate. And we'd love to start an investigative unit in Bob's memory to actually have a couple of reporters dig deep and try to come up with some exclusives. So these are all things dependent on money. We're almost 100% funded by readers. So that's going to be all dependent on how much we could raise. But we got some plans. I don't know whether we're going to be able to do them or not, but I'm hoping to carry the core was foreign policy of the United States and being critical of the U.S. foreign policy. You know, in that speech, Don, I also mentioned how I became, 16 years after he started that in 95, one of those journalists that Bob created this for, that I learned through some bad experiences that my articles were also being spiked or complained about. For example, I covered the lead up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq at the UN, at the UN Security Council, at that time for a Canadian chain. It was called Southern News then, and they published the Montreal Gazette, the Ottawa Citizen, Calgary Herald, and about 20 other papers. And I was covering the Security Council deliberations, and I was giving equal weight in my stories to what the German, the French, and the Russian delegations at the Security Council were saying. They were opposing the invasion. So I got a call from the foreign editor of this Southern News chain, and he started berating me. He called me from Ottawa. He berated me for not supporting the war effort. And he told me his son was a Marine, Canadian Marine.
Jeez.
I said, well, I'm sure you're very proud about your son, but my job is not to support the war, but to report what's going on at the Security Council, and they are opposing this resolution. Of course, the Bush administration never got that resolution, but they invaded anyway.
Right.
And it was illegal, as Kofi Annan, the then Secretary General, finally admitted in an interview with the BBC after being pressured by the interviewer. He admitted it was illegal, and then he got hounded into a near nervous breakdown by the likes of then UN Ambassador John Bolton, who has unfortunately gotten a promotion since then. I, on the other hand, was on the day of the invasion, 2003, was fired by
Canadian
chain. Yes.
Wow. I remember that day too. Jeez, I don't not your firing, but that day. Yeah. You know, I've been looking at this, like the entire landscape now with everything around around Trump, around Washington, around the U.S. and Russia, all of this. And watching it develop for a couple years, and I watched the public narrative, and I don't mean just the nonsense that's on TV and in the newspaper, but what people actually say, like at the at work, at the virtual water cooler now, whatever, in the supermarket, what they know, and I'm amazed that because I'm reading foreign media and talking to people in different places about this stuff, and so I know what people think, a good representation of what people think around the world. And I'm shocked that most people don't. And I'm looking at the talk that you gave, the eulogy that you gave for Robert, to the part where you said when you were doing this for the Montreal Gazette and those papers, that you gave equal weight to your stories to German, French, and Russian opposition on the Security Council. In other words, like, I listen to the whole Security Council meetings so I can hear, and I always like to hear what Bolivia says, for example.
Yeah.
They really lay out a lot of facts and a pretty good critique of the U.S. actions. But each one, they lay out some facts and they give you a perspective that's not the one being sold here. And, I'm reading what you wrote. It's clear to me it's not just an error of omission, but one of commission. It is affirmatively blocked out of the media here what other people are saying outside of their narrative.
That starts right at the source, at the Security Council, at the UN, when Western, and I saw this for 25 years as a UN correspondent, the Western correspondents close to Western ambassadors, the British, the French, and the Americans. They parrot what they're told, and they creates, there's an entire atmosphere that's built up over months and years that Syria, whatever the Syrian or the Russian or the Bolivian delegation says, is absolutely not to be taken seriously. That these people are off the wall, that they have a problem, they're jealous of the West, of the power. You know, they're just ridiculed. They're not taken seriously. And the reporters who are vain and who are more interested in living through the power of politicians and diplomats vicariously to their power than exercising the power that the press has, which is distinct from governments, which is to hold government to account, to be a filter between what government says, and they all lie in government. All governments lie.
Right.
People in governments lie. So the press, there's another party involved here, two parties, the press and the public. And the press is supposed to be the filter between what government's saying and what the public receives, and to hold them to account, to challenge them, and then to, as best as you can, to present what the facts are and what closest to the truth as possible to the public. But the press is absolutely abdicated that responsibility. They've given up that power. They are careerists and they're vain and they're living through the power of government and they want to get close to them. It's not just about access. It's a mentality that's the same. And therefore, we don't have a real functioning press in general anymore. And that's what Bob Parry created with Consortium News and why I'm so thrilled to be able to try to carry on his work, because I saw that every single day at the UN. I saw it at the Wall Street Journal. And it was at that speech on Monday that I first publicly revealed that. And I will tell you now that there were several stories at the Journal that either spiked or suppressed before publishing or changed after publication. For example, the Defense Intelligence Agency document declassified that said the U.S., Turkey, and the U.S. Gulf allies were supporting Salafists in eastern Syria to put pressure on President Assad, and that it warned that those guys could turn into an Islamic State by aligning with similar jihadists in Iraq. It even used that term, Islamic State, and that is in August 2012, 2 years before the Islamic State was actually born. I pitched that story twice to the Wall Street Journal. It was twice rejected. I've seen it nowhere else in corporate media. That would undermine completely the American narrative on the war on terror. And then I wrote a couple of stories leading up to the vote on the Palestinian observer state status back in 2011 at the UN General Assembly. And I kept mentioning in the story, which I thought was an extremely relevant fact, that 130 countries already recognized Palestine and some had exchanged ambassadors. That kept being taken out of my stories. Wow. In the lead up to this vote. And of course, Palestine eventually got like 170 votes. It was only in that day that they of the story that they allowed me to publish that information. So I realized then, of course, the Journal had an agenda, as most of corporate media does, and that agenda is not to be neutral in covering international affairs, to look at the clash of different nations in complex situations and to describe what their interests are, what motivates countries, but to promote American interests abroad. That is what the corporate media does. That is not journalism. That's something very, very different than that. So that's when I turned to Bob. It was after that Palestinian story that I turned to him. He didn't know me from a hole in the wall. I sent him my article on this. He published it. And then for 6 years, I published many stories on Consortium News, and he was the guy who gave a home to me and to other journalists. And then, of course, former intelligence agents like Ray McGovern, Phil Giraldi, right, and Paul Pilar published regularly at Consortium, and activists and other people started to publish there as well. But it was created for other journalists to publish work that was being suppressed. And that thing has gotten worse, as you're saying, I think, Don.
Yeah.
It's gotten worse to control than even years ago, even when Bob was first ran up against those obstacles back in the 1980s.
Well, I mean, maybe you can, because you were at the UN all that time, so maybe you can tell me about how it was. But even now, if you look at the server of for UN media, unmultimedia.org, you have the audiovisual library where you can do a direct download of a file, including an entire Security Council meeting, if it's put up there. And then you have live from UN webcast where everything that is recorded gets stored, but you can't do a direct download from there. For example, if there's a Security Council meeting, say that doesn't go well for the United States, or that the United States doesn't want people to be readily access, say, the Syrian ambassador's comments or Russia's ambassador's comments. It'll be at the webcast, and the only way you can get that is to play it real time. So a 3-hour Security Council meeting, for me to capture it, I have to play it back. It takes 3 hours to record it off the clip. The things that go into the audiovisual library, you can just do a direct download. It takes 30 seconds of that meeting. You can tell that somebody is saying, nope, not this one, nope, not that one. That's at the head end of what goes to the press.
Look, there have been instances where Bashar al-Jafri, the Syrian ambassador to the UN, his microphone was cut on UN broadcasts at the General Assembly. It's happened, I think, more than once. Mm-mm-mm. Questions were raised about that. You never get a straight answer. They say it's a technical problem. You never know whether that's true or not, but it's very suspicious. I mean, that's just one small part, Don, of how big powers, and since the end of the Cold War, the United States almost exclusively pressures the UN to follow its line. And I actually have a big book proposal on it, on the history of the that relationship between the UN and the big powers, the United States, particularly the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and each Secretary General, how they stood up to the United States. And we only really see Dag Hammarskjöld, the only one who stood up to both the Soviets and the Americans, and maybe he lost his life because of that.
Yeah.
So this is a crisis at the UN, and that's a part of it. I mean, those kind of mechanicians at the multimedia center there, what I don't know exactly what's going on. I can't tell you, but it does look very suspicious. And but it's part of, it would fit right into the idea of silencing or marginalizing what these guys say, what the Russians say, the Bolivians, the Chinese, the Syrian ambassador. It doesn't get play in the Western media. These voices of the Iranians and the North Koreans and the Syrians and the Palestinians, they are either suppressed completely or marginalized to the point where you dehumanize people in those countries. And that makes it easier to go to war against those countries, to get U.S. public support, when you don't know, the American people don't know what these people think, what they say, what their point of view is, what their interests are. Instead, there's this cartoonish presentation of American foreign policy as being somehow moral. Rather than it just following its interests, mostly violently, as all great powers do. That's what the United States is. It's following its interests abroad. That's what big, powerful countries have done in history, what empires have done in history. But we are somehow made to believe by supposedly serious journalism like the New York Times and others that the United States has a moral equation in what they do. Just take the airstrikes against Syria, which was, we don't even know if there was a chemical attack the other day. And the United States was not threatened in any way by that. It was not under Article 51 of the UN Charter of Self-Defense.
Right.
Security Council certainly didn't authorize it. It's illegal under international law and under U.S. law, so it's Congress never authorized that. So they keep peddling this story that America did it to save the people's lives from chemical attacks. And it's a moral – I mean, it's absolute rubbish. And I think more and more people are not buying it, but the American mainstream media keeps pushing this line. They give a platform to those guys at the Pentagon saying that, or to Trump saying that, instead of challenging that, and very easily doing that by giving some historical perspective of this war in Syria and certainly of American post-war behavior that has not been very moral. But we don't get those stories. That's all left out, unfortunately, and that's the sin of omission, I think, is the greatest sin of the corporate media.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that they could stop omitting would be at the bottom of the screen, as whenever they run a news piece about any of these things, just run the body count, at the hands of the U.S. since 1945. Okay, I realize it'll look like that stupid, deficit clock that they've had
in
New York.
It wouldn't fit under the screen.
You need a HD screen so it's wide enough.
Yeah. You need a 50-inch TV easily to be able to read that.
It's interesting that you said the public narrative that's been peddled by the media has been so decoupled from reality for so long that there's actually a huge vector that's almost impossible to recapture, because it is just disorient too many people. But I thought all those things were true. Now this is true, kind of a thing. And I'm looking at what just happened in Syria and wondering if we're not seeing that kind of play out. Like, I was trying to figure out what exactly is the real purpose behind what Trump just did. I understand how he's getting forced into some things, and there's also a push, what's-her-face, off the front page thing that went on. It goes back to at least Bill Clinton bombing Iraq right. every time they went to impeach him or whatever. But I'm thinking about the fact that they decided to say, we found chemical weapons factories. We have not. I mean, no one has said we've proven that that they belong to the state and this was the source of those things. It's assumed that, but no one's actually holding, you know, they've been pretty deliberate about leaving that a little mushy. And I'm wondering if what they're going to end up doing is just saying, look, the Russians got rid of 90% of it. We blew up the rest of it. We can say with confidence the government doesn't have those weapons. So if there's another use of them, they can flip the narrative, and it will make sense to the people that have been following the public narrative. In other words, I don't know if I'm making it clear, but basically my point is that the public narrative has been so decoupled from reality that I'm wondering if some effort isn't being made, or in any event, doesn't some effort need to be made to try to reconcile the illusion that people have of reality with some, you know, becoming awareness of reality.
Yeah, consortiumnews.com.
Right, okay.
Well, that's what we're trying to do here by completely bypassing the corporate media and going to facts such as the 100% of the Syrian chemicals that were banned on the OPCW banned list.
Right.
Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. 100% were removed from Syria, were destroyed on a U.S. naval vessel in the Atlantic Ocean, was certified by John Kerry, then Secretary of State, by the U.N. Security Council, and by the OPCW itself. They had destroyed those chemicals. Chlorine, which is believed to have been used in this latest attack in Douma, the suburb of Damascus, is not on the OPCW banned list. Every country in the world is allowed to possess it. You're not allowed to use it as a weapon, but you're allowed to have it. So when you get Christian Amanpour saying on the night of the attack, right after the bombs started falling, that the Allies had no choice because they have chlorine and they have still chemical weapons that were banned, she's completely wrong about that and not corrected. So they actually either knowingly or unknowingly, and it could be just ignorance there, because she was pushing this idea, as so many pundits did, as the generals who are wheeled out onto CNN and others who have contracts with arms manufacturers that they never disclose, are cheerleading for war. They're talking about the equipment that's being used, the very equipment these guys are going to peddle. It is so damn obvious. And they leave out the questionable facts of this, the fact that Mattis, James Mattis, the defense secretary, the day before had said, we don't have evidence on Capitol Hill. He went to the White House to try to get a delay on this until there was evidence that there ever was even a chemical weapons attack. And the next day he was out there saying he had the evidence, but he wouldn't say what it was. They don't have the evidence. The guys who worked in some of those buildings that were destroyed said they were making antidotes to snake venom. There were no chemicals released anywhere. I think this was an effort by the United States to show they're still relevant in Syria. They are losing the war there, but they don't want to let Syria stabilize. They need to stay there and screw things up. And now, ominously, they're asking, and the Saudis today offered troops to go to eastern Syria to augment or replace with the United States contingent there. So it looks like that plan to divide Syria, or at least take that eastern part, is coming to be. And U.S. needed to show off by blowing up some bombs again. They're not to be dismissed or taken lightly. And it wasn't a thumb in, you know, to slap in the face to Vladimir Putin. It was an attempt by Trump to show that he was tough on Russia, and he has to get that porn star off the front pages, etc. So it's a disgusting display that we saw. Fortunately, nobody was killed, apparently, but what we've seen before from the United States, and unfortunately what we will see again. And it's the media that we're focusing on in this conversation, that I'm focusing on, because we need alternative media to step up, and Consortium is one of them that's going to run stories, and we have a whole bunch on Syria in the last 2 days that I've published, and I got two or three more today that I'm going to to run, that are challenging this dominant narrative that's based on misinformation, ignorance, or outright lies.
Yep. So, as you grapple with, taking over the reins there, what are some of the challenges that you see other than the looming figure of Bob?
Learning how to use WordPress. Absolute challenge. It's a really, they have a free model and a designer model. You need to know code to do some things, and I don't. So we may be moving to a different system, so I can work with the layout very soon. What I'm saying, I'm half joking, but I am saying there are practical issues here in learning how the system works. Moderating comments. Comments is a huge headache, I think, for any website. We have a system that automatically pulls out some comments and needs to be then manually checked. Some of them are perfectly fine. We have no idea why they're being pulled out. And then people are getting upset that their comments have not appeared for several hours. Those, apart from those practical matters, getting new writers in, to bring new voices in, to expand our coverage into different issues, race relations, women, labor, as I said, and other political domestic issues, without touching the core of criticism of American foreign policy, which is my background, which is what Bob wrote mostly about. It's not just going to be Russiagate, 100% of the time. We're going to continue to stay on that story and continue to be skeptical of that. Consortium News made its mark, Bob made his mark again by being highly skeptical of the stories of Russia's interference in the election without any strong evidence being made. So we're going to continue to run stories like that. And once I get things up and running and all systems go, I'm going to try to start writing more myself. I will never replace the piece in quantity or quality that Bob wrote, but I'm going to contribute, my 2 cents on as often as possible. I think it's going to be recognizable as the Consortium News that Bob, but very different in a lot of ways because of a lot of new writers and topics that we're covering, but also because of the absence of Bob's stories, a hole that will never obviously be filled.
Joe, thank you very much. And we'll be following you for sure. And hopefully speaking with you again real soon. Best of luck in this new endeavor.
Well, thank you, Don. It's great chatting with you.
Same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Does American foreign policy possess a specific DNA? It would seem so. It doesn't matter who the president is. It doesn't matter which party controls the White House. One can easily ask the following question. Is Trump's time in office serving George W. Bush's third term or Barack Obama's third term? The neocons are firmly in the saddle. Crosstalking American Foreign Policy, I'm joined by my guest, Hillary Leverett in Washington. She is currently CEO of Strategica, a political risk consultancy, and co-author of the book Going to Tehran. Also in Washington, we have Michael Flanagan. He is president of Flanagan Consulting and a former congressman. And in New York, we cross to Don DeBar. He is an anti-war activist and host of a daily radio program. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Hillary, let me go to you. Off the back of my introduction, I mean, there seems like an enormous amount of continuity in American foreign policy, particularly in this century. I mean, if I didn't know better, I could assume if I didn't know who the president was based on the campaign, it would be Hillary Clinton in office right now. And that terribly disappoints me because that was the only reason why I even took an interest in Donald Trump, because he said something different. And now I guess he's gotten in line. Go ahead, Hillary, in Washington.
Yeah, since the end of the Cold War, there has been a bipartisan consensus for an incredibly interventionist U.S. foreign policy to consolidate the sole superpower nature of U.S. power in the wake of the Cold War. I worked in the Clinton White House, the National Security Council, and at the time, I was asked to help write an article in Foreign Affairs magazine called The Rogue Regimes, where the United States was going to go after the rogue regimes, Iran, Iraq, and Cuba. You know, flash forward a few years, there I am in the Bush National Security Council, Bush 43, and there's the Axis of Evil speech, which is almost word for word what the Clinton doctrine was for Iran, Iraq, and Cuba just a few years before. And then we have Obama in Libya and Syria, and now we have Trump, too, with his attacks in Syria. So there is an enormous amount of continuity for an interventionist U.S. foreign policy to preserve, in their view, to preserve American power and American hegemony around the world, but particularly in the Middle East.
Okay. Michael, let me go to you in Washington. When I hear bipartisan consensus, I get really, really worried because that means there's no dissent. Don't disagree. Put your head down and just do what you're told. And that's exactly what's happening. And I'd like to add to that is that the mainstream media, the corporate media, they're just stenographers for that same message. Go ahead, Michael.
You're not entirely wrong, but I think this president is a little different. I think if we really had a neocon in office, we'd have 50,000 troops on the ground in Syria, and we'd be looking at a long occupation. I think what you have is a reaction to chemical weapons, at least insofar as they believe it to be true. And I think that's really all you have. There's nobody talking about putting many troops on the ground for an occupation,
well,
or hopefully, God
Michael,
save us, a reconstruction
but don't
later.
But don't you
and I think that's really a great difference.
Don't you think that's a distinction without a difference? I mean, really? Okay.
Not at all. Not at all. The cost and time and energy have spent of the Iraq invasion and occupation is not happening in Syria. The cost and time and expense and reconstruction of the Afghan invasion and occupation is not happening in Syria.
Well,
and while Hillary is absolutely correct, we have a bipartisan agreement for interventionism. Absolutely. This is interventionist. There's no question that that is true. It is not the same as the neocons' dream of U.S. world hegemony.
I think there's a... Let me go to Don here, because this is really contentious here. Now, Michael, we have also now Pompeo and Bolton. So maybe you aren't giving the president a chance to get up to speed with the men that followed that were before him. Okay, no, because I'm saying this, Michael. I'm going to ask Don here. You know, Donald Trump has caved on everything when it comes to foreign policy, virtually. Okay, go ahead, Don. You've been listening.
First, on the point of bipartisanship, this is something I always like to just use as context. The only time you know for certain that American politician is telling the truth is when they call another American politician a crook, because they're almost always right, regardless of party. So when you talk about bipartisan consensus, those are the players that we're talking about that are usually, you know, reaching this consensus. It tells you something about the thing that they're agreeing on, what's really behind it. With Trump and the whole foreign policy, program that's been implemented so far or stumbled through or whatever since he took office. You know, you have to go back to him pronouncing the heresies that haven't been spoken since World War II, really, by any major party candidate or even any national, someone seeking national office in the United States, challenging the foundational assumptions. NATO perhaps is no longer needed because it was supposed to defend against the Soviet Union, which has been gone for 25 years. Regime change, no good, bad idea. Let's take the money that we're spending on the military and build infrastructure. These are heresies that no one was ever allowed to speak. And because Trump was Trump and was drawing people to television sets during the campaign because he was running, they couldn't turn the cameras off on him like they did on Howard Dean and others that they had, you know, fallen out of favor with the media. So now he comes into office. The context is he committed a series of major crimes, all involving being subservient to a foreign power, the evil one, the one that's been the evil one going back to 1917. So everything that he does that's outside of foreign policy convention is going to be looked at through the prism of, is this Putin pulling his strings? And what's happened is that despite some very bad steps taken, you know, in the opinion of most of the world, and by the way, violating international law on a number of occasions.
Okay.
He has actually stepped the U.S. out of the way in the main in Syria to allow Russia, Iran, and them to deal with ISIS, and some other things have happened like that on the international stage as well.
Okay, Hillary, you wanted to jump in there. So much has already been said on this program. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that Trump, in some ways, has tried to distinguish himself, but in a way, like other presidents, that he is going to pursue American dominance in a smarter, cheaper way. Each of the other presidents before him have tried to do that. He, though, does seem to constantly be trying to come back to his campaign promises to extricate U.S. forces, especially from the Middle East. And I think he's doing that not necessarily because he's a principled person, but because he sees the polls. He sees U.S. public opinion polls here, and he knows that the 2018 November midterm elections are critically important for him. If the Congress here, if the House of Representatives especially, turns and is not controlled by Republicans, he would be in danger of impeachment. So he's got to go back to what worked for him in the 2016 campaign. There you have the schizophrenia in a way, because he's trying to appeal to that base to come out in November. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he's had to staff his cabinet with neocons, from Vice President Pence to the new Secretary of State designate Pompeo to his new National Security Council advisor John Bolton. So that's where the schizophrenia comes from. I think it's this attempt to try to get his domestic base out in November. They do not want another war in the Middle East. They do not want U.S. troops and treasures squandered abroad. He has to then deal with the fact that he's staffed his entire the upper echelons of his government with neocons.
You know, Michael, Trump really puts himself into a very tight corner because he's disappointing members of his base, people that were very, very supportive of his foreign policy approach during the campaign. And then you have the foreign policy swamp, the blob, and the media that says, well, you're a wimp because you only hit three buildings in a Damascus suburb. I mean, he's stuck between the two of them. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you that I watch the Republican right, the way right, the moral equivalent of the progressives on the left a lot closer maybe than a lot of people do. And I'll tell you, their furor with bombing Syria is not so much that they blew up a couple of buildings in the Damascus suburbs, but that it's a harbinger of the troops that will come, of the treasure that will be spent, of the lives that will be spilled. It's not going to happen. And as long as it doesn't happen, they're going to be fine, just like they were a few months ago when we bombed Syria.
My only reaction to that is, Michael, is that everybody said Trump wouldn't be president. Okay, so never say anything like that. Okay, Hillary, you want to jump in right before?
Well, okay, I said Trump would be president.
I mean, the numbers would belie that.
I think I'm going to call this one right too.
Okay, go ahead, Hillary.
Yeah, and with all due respect, you know, I think it's important to actually look at the numbers. There are declared over 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, which, of course, pales in comparison to what Bush did in Iraq. But still, there are over 2,000 declared U.S. troops. Now we've had come out just in the past few days, the Washington Post is reporting that there are over 5,000 U.S. contractors there in a military role. You also have a dramatic increase in U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So for all that Trump says he wants to leave, and he wants to declare victory over ISIS, especially in Syria, for all of that attempt that he's trying to put forward to extricate the U.S. from places like Syria and Afghanistan, the reality is that you still have, I wouldn't even call them the neoconservatives. I would call them the traditional foreign policy elite, including General Mattis at the Pentagon, who are pushing and pushing constantly for more troops, more sanctions, more U.S. coercive power, not just in the Middle East, but also vis-a-vis Russia and China.
Okay, Don, let me go to you before we go to the break.
I think you confused.
Make sure I get Don in here for equal time. No problem. Don, you know, what Hillary just described is mission creep, okay? Because Trump caved on NATO. He caved on Afghanistan. He won't do anything on Yemen, which is really a shame on the entire foreign policy elite in the West. Very shameful. 40 seconds, Don, before we go to the break. Mission creep. Go ahead.
Well, all of these things are happening in a larger context. You have what's been driving American foreign policy for decades is the idea of hegemony and the actualization of hegemony largely across the world. That period has passed. Perhaps it's an epical shift even. We're seeing a multipolar world rise. We're seeing it actualized. And so the foreign policy perspectives of everyone really has to either ignore that and try to undo it, which I think is impossible and means World War III, essentially, or accommodate it. I believe inside the elites in the West, and I think that Trump in a very strong way represents this, you know, one of these tendencies, that there are some that acknowledge the old model doesn't work. It's okay to be at the table with other people. We come with many things of value.
I got to jump in here.
And so that's what I think is going
on. I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Hillary in Washington. Vigilante foreign policy and the great powers. And let's put those two together. France, Britain, and the United States reordering the Middle East again, okay? And acting outside of international law in norms. You know we had these defense and intelligence postures coming out and, you know, revisionist powers, Russia, Iran, you know, China. You know, no, who's the revisionist right now? Who's destroying the UN Charter, going beyond the United Nations Security Council? I mean, it's truly astounding. Of course, the political elite and their pliant stenography media can't even see, you know, 2 inches from their own face. OK, the pure hypocrisy. I'll tell you, this is destroying the international order. And being I was trained as a professional historian. Remember the League of Nations, OK, when everyone started ignoring it at everyone's peril. I don't think there's a question there, Hillary, but I think you know what I mean. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, but I think it's a critically important point because you have essentially You have Britain and France in very weak positions that have apparently, seemingly decided to align themselves firmly with the United States and not be independent powers. So you really have the UK and France aligning with the United States to just reinforce whatever the United States wants to do, which leaves the international community without any real balance, which was the brilliance of having the P5, the permanent five members of a Security Council and a Security Council in the UN, to have this balance, a multilateral balance in international affairs. That is slowly but surely being destroyed. Yep. And we see with that real devastation, strategic devastation across the globe as the United States is unable to accommodate itself to the reality of a multipolar world where other countries have power and they're going to exercise it. The only way for the United States to truly be safe in that environment is to work in a balance of power environment with other countries. But instead, you have people here in Washington especially holding on to this idea that really blossomed in the wake of the Cold War in the 1990s, that the United States not only could be, but has to be the sole superpower in order to protect itself. That is really what's so dangerous and what I'm concerned is happening right now.
You know, Michael, I want to stay with Britain, France, and the United States. They worked in conjunction in striking illegally, I would point out, Syria on a pretext that, oh, I thought we heard this story last year. It repeats again. Remarkable. Nobody likes to point that out. So if you don't think this intervention is going to expand, well, I think the past would say differently. So what do you think, Michael? How much are the British and French going to contribute to this intervention? Are they just going to wave flags on the sidelines? Okay, because that's exactly what they'll do. Everybody in the Middle East wants America to do something in the Middle East for their interests, but it's not even in America's interest in the first place. Go ahead, Michael.
I got 14 premises there, Peter, and I love you, but I'm having trouble keeping my head around all of them, so let me try here.
Okay.
I don't think that we are going to be interventionist, and you've asked me to comment on something I don't believe, so I just don't think it's going to happen. Secondly, very quickly with Hillary and the numbers question before the break, the numbers there are aimed at ISIS, not at toppling the regime in Damascus as they would be if we were neocons.
Really?
And that's simply, it's
really?
Just not happening. They're coming and they're going.
Really?
Let me finish. Well, I'm sorry, Ost, yes, okay. I don't think it's about toppling Assad. I think it's about stopping chemical weapons and defeating. And the troops are there to defeat ISIS. You know, it has nothing to do with
Michael,
Assad. And
why,
I think you'd have trouble proving otherwise.
When you look at American intervention, look at all the bombing that the United States and its allies have done during the entire course of this war. What they've done is destroy the infrastructure of the Syrian state. No, they didn't go after ISIS. They didn't go after al-Nusra. No, they didn't. What they try to do is erode the sovereignty of Syria. And then the Russians come in, invited in under international law. And then all of a sudden you see the Islamic State starting to shrink. And of course, Trump, maybe willingly, unwillingly, takes credit for it. OK, there's no reason to believe the good intentions of the United States in Syria when its aims are not clear. And when you have someone like Nikki Haley saying we got to keep our eye on Iran for maybe a moment, she was transparent. I'll let you finish your point, Michael. Go ahead.
Thank you, Peter. I try never to interrupt the host because your vision is insightful. But I think in this case, a tiny bit misplaced because you anticipate. You are insightful, but you anticipate something that I don't think is going to come to pass.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to have 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 troops on the ground in Syria. It's just not going to happen, whatever the numbers state. And I'll go one more and I'll say that if we could get this Mueller commission over with in the United States, Trump could sit with Putin like he sits with the premier of China and others and reach a thoughtful accord. I mean, Mr. Lavrov, if I'm not mistaken, observed recently that there's a slow-moving, slow-rolling coup d'etat going on in the United States. I think it's a little overstated, but I think he anticipates the two men sitting down. And Trump's foreign policy is very personal. It's very it's his personal involvement. It's not well staffed. If you want to be irked about that. But I think if he has a chance to sit with Putin and do what he has to do, I think you'd see a very different Syria. And I certainly see a very different world complexion. He's making great strides with the Chinese in ways that this nation hasn't done before. I think the North Koreans announced today or yesterday or sometime in the near past that they were going to actually look at finally ending the Korean War. That's an incredible stride forward.
Well,
and it absolutely had to involve the Chinese and Americans working together.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, Michael, and I'll pass this over to Don. They might end their hostilities. They might actually sign a peace treaty. But, Michael, be prepared for that to happen. The United States must withdraw from the peninsula. See, that the other side of the
story, that's
how the media works, okay? So we might get peace on Korea in spite of Trump, not because of him. We'll see. All right, let me go back to Don here. I mean, we had a number of cases during the Obama administration where we had a ceasefire in Syria. Okay, and then we have these false flag attacks. We have Ash Carter destroy a very hard worked on ceasefire. I see the same thing repeating. And I said in the introduction of my program, it doesn't matter who's president. It doesn't matter what party's in power. We have elements within the deep state. Hillary has already talked about it here. They're not going to let this happen because that would actually be a recognition that hegemony, the moment of hegemony, has come to an end. And that's like telling these neocons there's no God. Go ahead, Don.
Look, we know that, first of all, there have been battles on the ground in Syria between Pentagon-backed jihadis and Langley-backed jihadis. There are competing American interests on the ground in Syria. That's the point. And they are merely a manifestation of competing interests in Washington or in Washington and Langley or whatever were more or less bundled together for the period from 1945, perhaps, all the way up until last year. And that's started to come unraveled. I think Trump represents a distinct tendency against the trend that prevailed before. And I think what we're seeing in Korea, for example, is, a manifestation of that. And I think a recognition of it on the part of Pyongyang and Beijing. We have to remember what happened. Japan occupied Korea up as far into the peninsula as it could. The United States conquered Japan, and there's no other word for it, unconditional surrender, and essentially just occupied the military bases that Japan had used to occupy Korea up to that point. Then the United States gets into a war, some say tries to take the rest of the peninsula, whatever, And then you have essentially no peace since 1952. The United States has refused to withdraw from Korea. The United States has refused to sign a peace treaty with North Korea, has refused to allow the Korean Peninsula to reunify. Now, if you look at this moment, Trump is actually in a position to allow that to happen politically. If he came out of Korea talks with a peace treaty that allowed the U.S. to pull its troops out of Korea, he could actually benefit politically. And that's probably the first time that's true since 1952 for an American
president.
Well,
that's really interesting, but I'm not sure that that would be considered a victory for the deep state because, well, what about all those contracts and all those musicians and all those ships? You know, what a pity that would be. See, peace would really...
Exactly.
Peace is an impoverishing idea for the current foreign policy elite. I see you nodding your head. Hillary, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it would be devastating, I think, to the foreign policy elite here in Washington. But strategically, it certainly would be wise if Trump could have some sort of peace or settlement or reconciliation with North Korea that would unify the peninsula and have Korea as Korea, not North and South, but Korea as a state, as a nation, to balance along with Japan and China. That would lead to a much more stable environment in Asia and a much more effective position for the United States in Asia, and I would argue throughout the world. But that is something that the foreign policy elite here would hate, because it has to be essentially the United States against somebody to fuel both the military-industrial complex here, but also the foreign policy as they see it is not one of balance. It can't be one where you have a strong China, a strong Korea, a strong Japan. It has to be dominance, all of those countries having their power only because the United States lets them do so.
Yeah.
That to me is the strategic problem. And you have that in the Middle East too, where I agree with Mike in some ways that Trump may not want to have what's happening, but it is a slippery slope, not one that's accidental, one that is purposeful by the foreign policy elite to maintain American dominance. You know, they really screwed up in terms of Libya, Syria, Iraq. And the problem for them now is they're facing those countries not being part of the pro-American political and security order in the Middle East. And that is something that is unacceptable, regardless of what the outcome is, whether it's ISIS or a new ISIS. They can't accept those countries, Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Egypt, Iran. They can't accept those big, important countries as independent powers.
Well, that's absolutely true. And we didn't even have a chance to talk about the influence of Israel and Saudi Arabia on his thinking in terms of the Middle East here. I feel like we just hit the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to talk about. Michael, I really appreciate you coming on the program. We're always arguing with you. Always add value here. Okay, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in New York. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.